Sorry, I didn't realize how many buttons there would be. So coming up here. So anyway, it's good to see everybody this morning. It's good to be here. If you want to go ahead and turn in your Bibles to Numbers chapter 22, that's where we're going to be while Rodney is away from us this morning. And really want to take a look at what the Bible has to say about this man Balaam. And I think, as we'll kind of take a look, I think he really has a lot to say about him. And for me, I started taking a look at kind of these thoughts and these ideas a few weeks ago when it came to the kids' class a few weeks ago. And I was drawn to Balaam for a couple of reasons. One is he's not very far away from Exodus, and that's what's on my brain right now. But also, because of that, I don't know about you guys, but when I think about Balaam, the first picture that comes in my mind is Balaam and his donkey, right? The donkey that's going to speak to him. And that's a picture that I thought, you know, regardless of the age, you know, kids can maybe hopefully latch on to and think about and take some lessons away from that. But the more I kind of look at this text, and the more I read some stuff that other people have written and said and all those kind of things, the more I'm really amazed with what God's showing us with Balaam, right? And showing us in the scriptures. So that's what we want to talk about this morning. That's what we want to look at. And I think maybe if you're like me, you might be surprised by some things about Balaam. And for instance, by the way, how much the Bible actually has to say about him. You know, if you think about the text itself, the narrative of Balaam that starts in Numbers chapter 22, God devotes over three chapters, right? It goes into chapter 25, just giving this detail about the prophet Balaam and what he does. This man, by the way, that is a prophet of God, but he's not even an Israelite. In fact, in this story and in this narrative, Israel itself is more of a backdrop to the story than an actual character in this text. And not only that, but outside of the story itself, the Bible references Balaam a lot. In the Old Testament, it happens over and over again that the text points back to this as being a pretty pivotal moment in Israel's life. Moses is going to remind the people of the things that Balaam did and what happened because of those events in Deuteronomy. It's going to come back up in Joshua. Balaam's going to come back up in there. When we get to Nehemiah, Balaam comes up again, and also in Micah. You know, all these places throughout the Old Testament keep referencing back to these same events and these same times. And the New Testament isn't left out of that as well. The text we kind of read before this lesson this morning came from 2 Peter. Here Peter gives a warning about Balaam. In verse 15, forsaking the right way, they have gone astray. They have followed the way of Balaam, the text says. But not only that, looking at these things, we can also look to Revelation chapter 2, verse 14. So the church at Pergamum, that's here. Again, another warning that's being given about Balaam. Here the writer says, "But I have a few things against you. You have some there who hold to the teaching of Balaam." Again, another warning about this man. And again, in Jude verse 11, we see again talking about false teachers and talking about those things. It's referred to as Balaam's error that we're warned against there. So I think pretty quickly we can start to see that the Holy Spirit gave us a lot of detail about Balaam. He gave us a lot of detail about this man, about this prophet, and about what he did. So for us today, I think, number one, it's important for us to know the story. To know what's actually going on with Balaam, what's actually happening with the things that the Bible keeps pointing us back to. And ask a few questions along the way, too. Why would God give so much detail? You know, why would he devote so much time and so many verses to this man and to these things? And then, you know, and we bring back to the New Testament on some of these things. what is the warning of Balaam? What is the teaching of Balaam that we read about in Revelation chapter 2? What is the way of Balaam in 2 Peter chapter 2? His error that we see in Judah 11, that the Bible keeps warning us about over and over again. And ultimately, how do we avoid that ourselves, right? How do we avoid these things? So this morning, what I want to do is I want to spend probably the majority of our time talking about the actual story itself and maybe drawing a few observations kind of along the way. And then more quickly at the end, you know, make some overall conclusions and takeaways from these things. But I think it'd be good for us to start out by setting the scene of what's happening in Numbers chapter 22. Because there's a lot of things that are going on at the time. If we think about this, by the way, in terms of our Bible periods that we have there, so this is during the period of the wandering in the wilderness, right? So this is the 40-year period between the Exodus itself, when they've left Egypt, but it's before they've actually entered into Canaan. In Numbers chapter 22, it's actually right towards the end of that period, maybe the 38th, 39th year, that kind of time frame. Where we're introduced to Balaam. This is also the time through here that we see really the changing of a generation. If you go to right before this in Numbers chapter 20, that chapter is going to open with the death of Miriam, Aaron and Moses's sister. That chapter is also going to close with the death of Aaron. He's taken up to the mountain and he gives. He's giving this high priesthood to his son Eleazar, and he goes back to his father's on that mountain right there. He dies on that mountain. So both of these things in this chapter kind of signify sort of that ending of that generation that actually left Israel, this new generation that is in place. It's also around the time that we talk about the waters of Meribah. Buddy actually brought up in class some of the things that they were doing wrong, and hey, there's been much worse, but that's the actual place where Moses and Aaron were supposed to speak to the rock, and they struck the rock, and God said, because of that, because you didn't regard me as holy, you're not going to see Canaan. You're not going to enter into this place. This new generation too, they're doing the same things that their parents did. They're dying in the wilderness because of their own sins. We see the plague that comes upon the people and the bronze serpent, that whole picture that is being put on. That happens right before these events in Numbers 22. But at the same time, there's also a lot of things that are going on where God is giving victory to the people. And he's giving them victory over the surrounding nations already before they enter into Canaan. And word about this has spread. For the words that we have up there, so in Numbers chapter 26, so after the text that we're about to read, God tells them to number the fighting men of Israel. And if you go through all those numbers and add them all up, it's over 600,000 fighting men. And I've seen some people that, you know, if you take the numbers of that certain population and kind of extrapolate it out, so how big is the whole population, right? You know, I've seen estimates anywhere from 2 to 3 million people, you know, that we're talking about if you had over 600 fighting men, in this population. And right now, all those people, all that whole, Israel and that whole congregation, they're encamped at the plains of Moab. You can kind of imagine what that would look like, right? 2 to 3 million people that are encamped, in this place. And that's where we begin when Numbers chapter 22 opens. That's the scene that we see is Israel at the plains of Moab. And you may remember, by the way, the Moabites and the Ammonites, where they came from, these were descendants of Lot, right? So from descendants of Lot and his daughters and things that happened there, out of that came the nations of Moab, the nations of the Ammonites. And they have right now they're dwelling in a land east of the Jordan River is where they're located right now. It's interesting to point out too, by the way, so Deuteronomy records some things around the same event, and Israel is given a strict warning at the time. And that warning is they're not to touch Moab when they go into these things. They're not to contend with Moab. And the reason is because God has given them this land. I won't have it up here, but I'll read Deuteronomy chapter 2, beginning in verse 9. Moses is saying, "And the Lord said to me, 'Do not harass Moab and contend with them in battle, for I will not give you any of their land as a possession, because I have given Ar to the people of Lot for a possession.'" So that's what's happening with Israel. And really we have two main characters, I think, that show up into this reading when we talk about Balaam. And the first one is the king of Moab, Balak himself. So he's the king of the Moabite people, and he's looking over at this sea of people, right? They're dwelling in the plain of Moab. Israel is at his doorstep, and he knows that God has already given this people, Israel, victories over some of the other nations. He's seen that happening. And he's fearful what Israel is going to do to him, right? That he's going to fall prey to this same scenario. And I think we can understand that because Moab's not that big of a nation. You remember that in Exodus chapter 1, Egypt, this great nation, is scared of Israel and what they could accomplish. That's the whole reason they enslaved them in the first place, is they were worried they would rise up against them. And we see in verse 4 of chapter 22, Balak's actually talking with the elders of Midian, and we see how he feels about this, how he describes this. In talking of Israel in verse 4, he says, "This horde will now lick up all that is around us, as the ox licks up the grass of the field." You know, so Balak's saying, Israel can take us out, and it's going to be easy for them. It's kind of that view. So we've got to do something about Israel. We've got to be proactive about these things. And evidently, by the way, that passage in Deuteronomy, either Balak's never heard of it, or he doesn't believe it. But whatever the reason is, he's not. That's not entering into his calculus that Israel's not supposed to touch it. And the other person we see in this that Balak's going to introduce us to is Balaam the prophet. And he's brought into the story by Balak. And Balak's heard two things about Balaam. He's heard that he's a prophet of God, and he's heard that whoever Balaam blesses will be blessed, and whoever Balaam curses will be cursed. So Balak has in his mind that, okay, I'm gonna get with Balaam, because Balaam has the power to direct God and to curse these people. That's what he wants. And if he can just get Balaam to utter a curse, if he can just get him to say these words, then maybe that he can defeat Israel and avoid the fate of the other nations. That's his goal in these things. So that's what Balak does in this story. So Balak assembles kind of this envoy, right? He meets with these elders of Midian. He has all these princes. And I think it's interesting in verse 7 of Numbers 22, it says that they take with them the price of divination. So here Balak, and you can kind of imagine this, you know, here's a pagan king that's going to treat Balaam just like a pagan prophet, right? So they take with them money, and they take with them this message to Balaam. And I want to catch up with this and read that actual message. And by the way, so I kind of think of this story, there's really four places that these things kind of take place. So really four parts of the story. But I just put it like that to keep it in my mind. So this first part happens when they approach Balaam himself. And let's read the message to Balaam. Because it says, "Behold, a people has come out of Egypt. They cover the face of the earth. They are dwelling opposite me. Come now, curse this people for me, since they are too mighty for me. Perhaps I will be able to defeat them and drive them from the land, for I know that he whom you bless is blessed, and he whom you curse is cursed." So Balaam gets this message from the princes and from this envoy. They have these prices of divination, and he says, "Okay, well, here's what I have to do. I need to inquire of God. So why don't you stay the night? I'm going to go ask these things that you asked me. I'm going to go ask them of God, and whatever God says in the morning, I'll tell you. I'll tell you what God has to say." So that's exactly what they do in this. And God gives them an answer that night. God comes to Balaam, and he gives them his answer. let's see, in verse 12, and God said to Balaam, you shall not go with him, you shall not curse the people, for they are blessed. And just pause right there for a second, because I don't, you know, this is something I don't think any of us have trouble with the message that God is presenting here, right? You know, Balaam asked for an answer, and God's answer is no and no. You shall not go with them, and you shall not curse them, for they are blessed. So right now, the story is kind of humming along, and the next morning, Balaam wakes up, and he tells the princess, he goes, sorry, he says, the Lord has refused. The Lord's refused this, go back to your land. I'm not going to be able to do this. So the elders and the princes, they go back and they report to the king and they tell him, hey, Balaam is refusing these things. And you can almost see in the story, you know, what Balak's thinking, because Balak goes, okay, I know what's going on. Balaam's negotiating, right? He's negotiating these things. The idea is kind of every man has his price. So here's what we're going to do. I'm going to send you guys back there. I'm going to send more and greater honor and all those kind of things. And you tell Balaam that whatever you want, but I want you to curse these people. So this time that's exactly what happens. So they bring more princes. They bring more honorable people than were before, and they bring more money. And this is this is the message now that comes to Balaam in verse 17. For I will surely do you great honor, and whatever you say to me, I will do. Come curse this people for me. You notice in this, by the way, the only thing that's changed in this, so the request is exactly the same, except for Balaam's reward. That's the only thing that's changed in this. And I think it's probably good to note that if we think about this in context of any other prophet, I saw someone kind of bring this point out. I think it's a good one. Where any other prophet, we're talking about Isaiah, we're talking about Jeremiah, they probably would have said, God already gave me this answer. This answer is done. God said no. There's no misinterpreting that thing. You guys should just go back. Nothing's really changed. That amount of money isn't going to matter for these things. And the text, I think, would have been much shorter. It would have just been that few verses, right? If it had been recorded at all. But that's not what Balaam does. Balaam resets this scene again and says, okay, well, maybe this is what changed mind. Maybe God wanted me to have more money. That's kind of what must be going through Balaam's mind. Why don't you stay the night and I'm going to inquire of God again and let's see if God maybe changed his mind. Is that picture. So when we see this, and again, the only thing that's changed is his money. So God comes to Balaam again that night with the princes staying in his house. And this is where, when God starts responding to Balaam in verse 20, something seems off about the response. Right? This is not kind of what we expect when we're reading this for the first time. It seems odd to us. Let's go ahead and read beginning in verse 20. And God said to Balaam at night and said to him, if the men have come to call you, rise, go with them, but only do what I tell you. So Balaam rose in the morning and saddled his donkey and went with the princes of Moab, but God's anger was kindled because he went. That seems odd to us, doesn't it? For a couple of reasons. One is God's already told him, don't go and don't curse the people. And then also, when God told him to go, now God's anger is kindled against him. And I think there's kind of an illustration that's not my illustration, but I think we can kind of understand sort of what might be happening here in these things. So, and the illustration kind of goes like this. We pick on husbands for a minute. But if you imagine you're with, a group of guys that you haven't been with in a long time. Right? Maybe it's some buddies from college or something like that. You haven't seen them for a long time. You end up spending kind of a day with them, and you're enjoying yourself and all those kind of things. And they say, hey, tonight, we really want you to come with us. We really want you to, hey, come to the lake with us. It'll be really nice. It'll just be this old time sake group and all these kind of things. But at the same time, you know in the back of your head that hey, you've already had plans with your wife. That night, you guys were supposed to go out. You're supposed to do things, have a date night or something like that. So you call your wife and you say, hey, I know we had our plans, but would you mind if I skip out and go hang out with my friends, right? And your wife tells you, well, it is our anniversary, and we've been planning this for months, and we have a sitter and all these kind of things that are in place. I really don't want you to go. Right? I really don't want you to do those things. The man goes back to his friends and he says, hey, my wife, to use Balaam's word, my wife refused. She doesn't want me to go. But they don't take no for an answer, right? That's what's happening with Balak here. They don't take no for an answer, and they say, well, you know what? You should really come with us. It's going to be a lot of fun. How about if I pay for everything? You think about that. What's changed for the wife, right? Nothing has changed. But call back your wife and say, hey, it's even better than I thought. You know, it's not going to cost me anything. And on the phone, she says, sure. You know, you can imagine that situation, and you got to ask yourself, did she really give you permission to go out? You can imagine that even though she said the word sure, that's not where he should be, right? And I think that kind of paints a picture of a little bit of what's happening here is God's allowing Balaam to go. God's allowing him to pursue what's in his heart. We find out later, I think, more what God already knows in this context, which is what's in Balaam's heart. He allows him to go, but at the same time, he's saying, this is not where Balaam should be. And so God, the text tells us that God is going to set an angel to be an adversary to Balaam. He's going to put him in the road. Which brings us kind of the second part of our story, which the one I always think about with Balaam is Balaam and his donkey. So Balaam gets up early the next morning. He saddles his donkey. She's been with him for a long time. The text is going to tell us that she's been with him his whole life in these things. So he begins to ride on his donkey. And again, that angel of the Lord is standing as an adversary in front of him. And this is kind of an amazing picture. Because here, when the angel stands in the way of Balaam, and this angel has a sword drawn, the donkey can see this angel, but Balaam can't see the angel in this picture. So when they first come up on this, the donkey actually veers into a field, right? The donkey sees the angel, sees the sword. The donkey's not dumb and recognizes this danger and tries to go around. Balaam doesn't see this, and the first thing that Balaam does is he beats the donkey. So the angel goes a little bit further down the path. This time we kind of reset the scene, but the angel stops in a place where there's a vineyard on the left and a vineyard on the right, and there's walls on either side of the road. You can kind of imagine that picture. And the angel stands here, and the angel draws the sword again, and as the donkey approaches, the donkey tries to avoid this angel again. The donkey tries to avoid this danger, and he ends up pressing Balaam's foot against the wall. And Balaam at this point is very angry at the donkey and beats the donkey again because of what the donkey's doing. And the angel goes a little bit further down the road. So now this third scene that we see, and this time is a little bit different because the angel has stopped in a place where there's no place to go to the left and there's no place to go, to the right. verse 26 says there's no way to turn. And the donkey lays down in the middle of the road before she gets to the angel. And verse 27 tells us that Balaam's anger was kindled. And he begins to strike the donkey with his staff the third time. And here's kind of the amazing scene that happens, because God, at this point, he doesn't just open Balaam's eyes. And God doesn't just let the angel speak to Balaam right there immediately. You know, Balaam's been spending these last couple of nights talking with God. God doesn't speak directly to him. God opens the mouth of the donkey and has the donkey talk to Balaam in this text. And we'll read the interaction beginning in verse 28. Then the Lord opened the mouth of the donkey and said to Balaam, "What have I done to you that you have struck me these three times?" And Balaam said to the donkey, because you have made a fool of me, I wish I had a sword in my hand that I would kill you. And the donkey said to Balaam, Am I not your donkey on which you have ridden all your life long to this day? Is it my habit to treat you this way? And he said, no. You know what? It's amazing to think about this scene, and I'm surprised too. I don't know if you guys are, that the Balaam never thinks, you never see any indication that Balaam's surprised, right, in this conversation. He keeps going as soon as the donkey opens his mouth. But who's the reasonable one in this situation, right? The donkey is reasoning with Balaam. Have you ever stopped to think that I've been a faithful donkey, Balaam? And that there might be a reason that I'm acting this way? Have I ever acted this way? And about that time, God opens Balaam's eyes, right? Balaam can see the angel of the Lord, and we see what the angel says to him beginning in verse 32. And the angel of the Lord said to him, why have you struck your donkey three times? Behold, I have come to oppose you because your way is perverse before me. Again, God knows what we don't know yet, right? Which is Balaam's heart. He can say a lot of the right words, but in his heart, he doesn't have that. And the donkey saw me and turned aside before me these three times. If she had not turned aside for me, surely just now I would have killed you and let her live. This picture that's happening, why have you hit the donkey, right? Is what this angel says. If it wasn't for the donkey, I would have killed you and let the donkey live. You're not worth the donkey, right? Is that message that happens. And the angel says, your way is perverse, right? God's already told Balaam, no, this is not what I want. And even in this, Balaam still has in his heart that I still am trying to get this done. I really want to go. I want to get this reward. I want to do all these things. In verse 34, he tells the angel, now if it's evil in your sight, I'll turn back. Of course it's evil, right? Even the donkey knows that these things are wrong. It reminds me, Lee and I talked about, you know, the show Cops and things like that. We joke about it because if you just read the transcript sometimes, you know, a lot of those people that are on those shows are saying all the right words. I'm not resisting and I'm not doing that and I'm complying or all those kind of things. But when you watch the video of it, they're doing anything but that. They're running and they're flailing and they're trying to hide stuff. That's kind of what Balaam, his words aren't matching his action, I think is the picture that we have. We get a sense of this in the passage that we read this morning in 2 Peter chapter 2. Verse 16 says this, a speechless donkey with a human voice restrained the prophet's madness. Right? I think that gives a picture. Balaam is crazed. Balaam is mad, the text says, because he's trying to do everything he can to maneuver his way to get his will done. Is that picture. And at this point, when he says that, God lets Balaam go again. But he warns him again for the second time. Okay, Balaam, you can go, but you have to do everything that I tell you. So we get to really part three of this story where Balaam meets up with Balak. And remember, you know, it's been twice now that he's warned him, don't say anything that I haven't told you to say. Right? God's told him that once with the angel, and he told him it before he left, when he allowed him to go. But Balaam's the one that tells Balak what to do. He tells him what he should be doing. So he tells Balak, he says, I want you to build seven altars, and on those seven altars, I want you to get seven bulls, and I want you to sacrifice those bulls on those altars, and I want you to get seven rams and sacrifice those rams on these altars, and I want you to stand by these altars, and I'm going to go off on a hill, and I'm going to pray to God, and I'm going to inquire of the Lord, and I'll come back and tell you what he says. So that's exactly what they do. They set up all these things, all these altars, and Balaam goes inquire of the Lord. And it's interesting to see what Balaam does, because he basically says, Lord, see what all we've done? Seven whole bulls and seven rams and altars. Aren't you pleased with what we did with these sacrifices? Does that change your mind, God? Does that change your mind? Will you let me curse this people? And God gives a response. The text says that he puts a word in Balaam's mouth. So Balaam comes down off this mountain. He sees these princes standing by these altars. Everybody's expecting a curse. And then we see the response beginning in verse 7. where it says, "And Balaam took up his discourse and said, 'From Amram Balak has brought me, the king of Moab and the eastern mountains. Come curse Jacob for me, and come denounce Israel. How can I curse whom God has not cursed, and how can I denounce whom God has not denounced?'" And Balaam continues this blessing with a clear message that God is blessing this people, and God will never curse the people of Israel. So you can kind of imagine, this is what Balak has hired Balaam for, right? This is why he's hired him. So Balak's upset now, but they say, you know what, we're not going to give up. We're going to try this again. They're taken to a portion of the people, but it may be too much. So Balak takes Balaam to a place where he can only see a little sliver of Israel. He can only see a portion of Israel. And so they reset the scene. So they sit there and they say, okay, we're going to do the seven altars. They build seven altars. Seven rams on the altar. Seven bulls on the altars. The princes are standing next to the altars. Balaam goes up by himself to inquire of the Lord. And the Lord puts a word in Balaam's mouth. And when he comes back, we see verse 18 of chapter 23. This second time now. "And Balaam took up his discourse and said, 'Rise, Balak, and hear. Give ear to me, O son of Zippor. God is not man that he should lie, or a son of man that he should change his mind. Has he said, and will he not do it? Or has he spoken, and will he not fulfill it? Behold, I receive a command to bless. He has blessed, and I will not revoke it.'" So second time now, Balaam has blessed the people when he's been trying to curse. And I think it's interesting to note at this time, the king gives up. And he says, you know what, Balaam, this is not at all what I wanted you to do. If you can't curse the people, I sure don't want you to bless them. Just go home. But Balaam at this point, he's the one that says, let me try one more time. Let me do this one more time. We gotta find a way. If we could just get into the right position, God should let us to do this. So this time, they go to another chance, the top of Peor. And Balaam goes, and instead of setting all this up, he goes and he says, maybe it's that I'm looking at Israel. God doesn't like me to look at Israel when I do this. So he turns his back from Israel and he's facing towards the desert. Right? He's facing towards the wilderness. Maybe this will work. Maybe this is what God wants. And Balaam approaches God, and this time God actually shows him all of Israel. But he does it in a visionary way for Balaam. And when he comes back, he pronounces the third blessing when he comes back into these things. Balak at this time, he's mad. He can't believe it's been three times, three blessings that are having. He says, Balaam, I want you to go home. And before he could even go home, there's a fourth pronouncement that happens where Balaam gives a prophecy that Israel is actually going to take out Moab because of these things that have happened. That's going to happen. That after this time, that Israel will take out Moab and it'll be no more because of these things that have happened here. And again, pronounces a blessing on Israel. And I think there's a verse that I think really speaks to the thoughts of what's happening between the king and between Balaam at this time. Because I think this is how they, what's in their minds. In verse 11 says, "Now therefore flee to your own place," Balak saying this. "And I said, I will certainly honor you, but the Lord has held you back from honor." I think both of these men, both Balaam and Balak, think of God as holding them back, right? That's that picture. They don't look at the situation that they find themselves in and try to align their own will with God. They look at this and say, God's keeping me from doing something. How do I maneuver to get these things done? At this point, by the way, I think it really should be the end of the story in this. But this is not the end of the story. Balak goes home, but Balaam keeps on going. Balaam is still trying to find a way to curse this people of Israel. And we're actually not told this until Numbers chapter 31. But Balaam goes to the king and he tells him, "I know what you can do. If you can get your women to entice the men of Israel, if you can get them to entice them to worship Baal, if you can get them to participate in immoral worship, God will take care of them for you. And back in chapter 25, that's exactly what happens. You can see what he says here. Some of this is shown in Revelation, but behold, these on Balaam's advice cursed the people in Israel, back treacherously against the Lord and the incident of Peor. And so the plague came among the congregation of the Lord. And in chapter 25, we're told that 24,000 people died as a result of the advice that Balaam gave to Balak because of that pursuit of that money, pursuit of those things. So after this, by the way, so Balaam actually goes into battle, and Balaam's going to be killed here not too long from now. And that's the end of Balaam at this point. And that's the end of his story in these things. But with the rest of our time this morning, and this will be quicker through this, is I want to make kind of five observations about the story and about things that we see in this text. And number one, I think it's interesting to point out that in the story, did you notice that God only said no to Balaam once? The rest of the time he said okay, but he only said no to Balaam once. And in fact, you shall not go, and you shall not curse. Now we tell our kids that all the time. How many times should we have to say no? It's one, right? And all these kind of things. We expect our kids to know that. Balaam didn't adhere to this. He keeps asking over and over again. He keeps trying to maneuver right into that right position where if I do this, maybe God will allow me. And we see that today, right? You ever heard anybody say, "Well, the Bible only says that once," or "How important could it be if he only says it that much time?" Or you know what? There's way more passages about belief than there is about baptism, so belief must be much more important than baptism. How important was this command to Balaam? Right? This command cost him his soul. Number two in this, the idea that tolerance is not acceptance, I think, is a picture that we get out of this. You notice God allowed Balaam to do a lot of things, but that never meant that Balaam was acting acceptably to God. And we can see how Balaam could argue to us, right? Well, you know, God gave me this opportunity. God allowed me to go. God allowed me to set all these things up, and he stopped me in the road. He didn't stop me completely. He allowed me to go to Balak then. I was asking him the whole way. I've been praying to God. And you know, too, you almost think too about Balaam's success, right? Because of those things, Balaam was actually successful in a lot of the things that he wanted to do. He was successful in going to Balak. He was successful in causing harm to Israel. But again, just because there's that opportunity doesn't mean that God's okay with it. It's the same way today. I think sometimes when people don't see, we don't see God pronouncing judgment on people immediately, they take that to mean God accepts it. When really what God's doing, like we talked about in Exodus this morning, is really God's showing his mercy in those things by not pronouncing that judgment. Because what's really happening and what Balaam was doing in this text is like what Romans 2 and verse 5 says, "But because of the hard and impenitent heart, you are storing up wrath for yourself in the day of wrath, and when God's righteous judgment will be revealed," right? In these things. Number three with this, just want to point out the donkey's message in this. I think there's a few things to point out, but I really just want to bring out one, because I really like this picture. Because it's an interesting perspective that Balaam finds himself in. Because at the same time, there's this relationships of servants and masters, I think, that come on. When we talk about servants, we can compare them to the donkey, right? The donkey is the servant of Balaam, and Balaam is the servant of God. If we compare these two in this, when the donkey sees that God's opposing him or her, the donkey stops, right? The donkey has that reasoning in her. But when God stands in the way of Balaam, Balaam doesn't see it. He's only focused on his own desires. And that's the way that this donkey, this speechless donkey, reasoned with Balaam. He was more reasonable than Balaam. He was more just servant in these things. But we can also see the relationship of being a master. Because you know, God is obviously the master of Balaam, but in this picture, Balaam is also the master of the donkey. I think that's an interesting picture because, you know, we're told that two people's anger was kindled in this story, right? God's anger was kindled and so was Balaam's. But you notice how they reacted. When the donkey didn't go the way that Balaam wanted him to, Balaam beats the donkey. And he beats the donkey every time. In fact, in his words that he used, if you remember in that text, he says, "I wished I had a sword, and if I did, I would kill you," is what he says. Now contrast that to the reaction of the Lord, right? The Lord's anger was kindled. Balaam wasn't going the right way. God literally sent an angel with an actual sword that at any time could kill Balaam. But God didn't do that. God wasn't beating Balaam over the head with a stick. God didn't kill him with a sword because God was showing Balaam mercy. And so on both counts, right, we compare him from a master standpoint, as a service standpoint, Balaam's falling woefully short, right, in all of these things, in all of these qualities. Number four, with this, I think one of the big pictures that we can see in this, is that, God is faithful. You know, we talked about, Balaam found a way to make, to be successful, right, to cause harm to Israel. But you notice that was only when Israel sinned themselves, right? That he was able to do those things. And this picture that God is faithful to his promises, this particular promise goes way back to Abraham, right? Goes way back to Genesis chapter 12, when we first hear about the promises made to Abraham. And I just want to read these first three verses in chapter 12. And you can see the idea of the blessings and cursings come up. It says in verse 1, "Now the Lord said to Abram, go from your country and your kindred to your father's house in the land that I will show you, and I will make you a great nation, and I will bless you and make your name great, so that you will be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and him who dishonors you I will curse, and all your families of the earth shall be blessed." This promise that God's keeping, this faithfulness that God's keeping, goes all the way back to Abraham. And God is faithful, you notice, despite the Israelites, right? The fiery serpent, the things Moses and Aaron aren't even doing what they should at this time. God's faithful not because Israel is faithful. God's faithful because he's faithful. I think that's one of the pictures of this text. And the last thing I'll mention before the lessons yours this morning is I want to bring up these New Testament passages one more time because we see the warning that comes into place for here, and see, you know, what is that warning that we're being told? But 2 Peter 2 and verse 15, "They followed the way of Balaam the son of Beor, who loved gain from wrongdoing." Jude 1 and verse 11, "Woe to them, for they walked in the way of Cain and abandoned themselves for the sake of gain to Balaam's error." In Revelation 2 and verse 14, "The teaching of Balaam, who taught Balak to put a stumbling block before the sons of Israel." You know, these are things, I think, all traps that we can fall into ourselves, right? What did Balaam try to do? You notice he always tried to keep the Lord close to him. He always was praying to God. He was offering sacrifices. He did a lot of things. You could look and say, look at all the things that he's doing for God. But he put something in front of God. And he tried to love this gain, and he tried to appease God at the same time. And from our class in Matthew, just use the words that Christ used. You can't do that, right? Matthew chapter 6, "No one can serve two masters, for either he will hate the one and love the other, or he will be devoted to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and money." Right? That was Balaam's problem. He tried to have two masters, and as God tells us, that's we're unable to do that. So, and I'll put this up so Buddy can get ready for these things. But like our habit is for here, that we want to take the time now to offer the invitation, right? To look at our own lives and to heed the warning that Balaam gives us, to offer the Lord's invitation. If there's a public need for the group of Christians that meet here, to be able to come forward, to make your life right with God, to be baptized for remission of sins, we offer that now, that you can respond to the gospel as we stand and as we sing.